by an SCD colonel who outranked the major and who assigned her to his staff. She was subsequently noticed by an SCD general who outranked the colonel and who made her his adjutant, even though Marta had no idea what an adjutant's duties entailed. She found out when the general one afternoon forced her down on the divan in his office and put his hand under her uniform skirt. Marta hit him on the side of the head with a typically Soviet steel water carafe. The resultant scandal in the strangely puritanical KGB was exacerbated by the fact that the general's wife was the sister of an alternate Politburo member. Marta was hurriedly transferred to State School 4. She had no choice. Marta was going to learn to be a sparrow. Marta had the rare combination of a sublime allure and a superior intellect. The former quality served to attract hapless foreign diplomats, journalists, and businessmen. The latter gave her perspective and a keen eye for making influential friends. At the end of her nearly 20-year career, Marta was known as a Korolyeva Vorobei, Queen Sparrow. She had participated in scores of SCD honey traps, among which were included the recruitments by the KGB of a sex-crazed Japanese billionaire, a philandering British ambassador, and a reptilian Indian minister of defense. At the apex of Marta's career, she was the bait in the legendary seduction, compromise, and recruitment of a cipherine, a female code clerk working in the German embassy, the suborning of whom enabled the KGB to read German and NATO encrypted traffic for an uninterrupted 7 years. It was the only time Marta worked against another woman, but the recruitment was still taught at KGB higher school as a classic operation. Over the years, Marta's non-operational romances included discreet affairs with two members of the Politburo, with a general in the first chief directorate, and with various sons of influential officials in the collegium of the KGB. Many bushy-browed old bosses remembered her with affection. Thanks to these mentors, Marta was bulletproof and was given an SVR major's pension on retiring from sparrow operations by grateful, if exhausted, benefactors. Marta decided to enjoy life and see a little of the outside world, so she requested and was readily granted an overseas assignment to Helsinki. At first, Marta did not know whether Dominika was SVR clerical or administrative. She certainly was very young to be assigned overseas. The last name explained much, but the fact that Dominika had no steady duties in the Residentura came and went as she liked and spoke directly and privately with the resident suggested that she was in Helsinki under a special charter. Dominika's clothes were new. She must have been provided a wardrobe. Office gossip accelerated when it was discovered that this beautiful newcomer had been assigned a private apartment outside the block reserved for all embassy personnel. To Marta, that had a familiar ring to it. In the Residentura, she was correct, reserved, did her work quickly and well, with an uncommon intensity. On the street, Marta saw how Dominika's eyes flitted from people's faces to the doors, along the sidewalk, across the street, using normal movements to mask her constant glances. When they were sitting together at a cafe, there was the flash of gratifying intuition, a hint of playfulness, the brilliant smile. Marta knowingly identified Dominika's nearly unconscious use of her beauty, eyes, smile, body, in her interactions. And when they talked, Marta recognized how Dominika used techniques of conversation and elicitation. Quite a creature, thought Marta, and in operations. Beauty, brains, tradecraft, and incandescent blue eyes. It was apparent that she knew her duty, loved her country, but there was something beneath the surface, an underground spring bubbling unseen. Pride, anger, disobedience. And something else, hard to define, a secret side, an addiction to rebellion as if she courted risk. Marta wondered how long it would be before this young woman, with her discerning eye and natural instincts, would realize that the center's work was pokazuka, something done solely for effect, for show. Resident Volontov was an extreme example of the work ethic, the type of functionary who had run the KGB and the Kremlin for the last 70 years. They began walking out of the embassy at the end of the day, stopping at a local bar for a glass of wine and a sinful slice of caviar pie oozing creme fraiche and cheese. They spoke of family, of Moscow, of experiences. Dominika did not mention Sparrow School. Marta laughed and made Dominika laugh, and they walked arm in arm down the sidewalk at the end of the evening. One night in a bar, after smoothly telling a disgusting German to leave them alone, Marta told Dominika her life story about her career as a sparrow. She was proud of having served her country. She didn't think about the beastly years of the KGB. She was not in the slightest ashamed of who she was or what she'd done. Dominika's lip trembled, and she looked at her friend and began silently weeping. It was a long evening after that, but Marta knew everything about Dominika in the end. The assignment to pursue Nate, Uncle Vanya, Sparrow School, the Frenchman Delon, even Ustinov. The words came out of Dominika in a flood. There was no thought about elicitation or manipulation. The two women thereafter were simply friends. Evening after evening, cool and collected, Marta listened and thought, "My, how the Vlastitelli, the bosses, have wrung quite a lot out of this girl in such a short time." But Marta saw strength in Dominika, and something else. Marta suspected Dominika's exposure to the easygoing young American CIA officer was creating deeper reactions as well. To have said so would have been to imply that Dominika could not operate correctly, so Marta said nothing. "I don't know," said Dominika. "He's arrogant, he's facetious, he doesn't like Russia, or at least he doesn't give us much credit. Uncle Vanya believes he is a desperate operative." "He sounds unpleasant," said Marta. "But it should make it easier to work against him, even to sleep with him, to get what you want." She lit a cigarette and looked at Dominika leaning back in the booth. They were on their third glass of wine. "Not so much unpleasant as frustrating, but nice." She sighed. "I'm supposed to tell Volontov when I think he's operational, distracted. They want to catch him with his agent." Dominika was feeling the wine. "And do you know him well enough to do that?" asked Marta. "Will you be able to know?" Dominika brushed a lock of hair off her forehead. "I think I already have. I mean, I already do," she said. "And you ran right in and reported to Colonel Volontov," said Marta. She already knew what was happening. "Not exactly," said Dominika. "I told him I would keep watching." "And you positively did not report that you suspected your young American was becoming busy?" "He's not my young American," said Dominika, her eyes closed. "But you suspect it so, and Volontov asked you outright and you didn't say a thing, correct?" asked Marta, leaning toward Dominika. "Open your eyes, look at me." She opened her eyes. "Correct. I didn't say anything." She closed her eyes. Marta sipped her wine, noting with some detachment that Dominika not only had committed treason against the state, saying treason against the Duma sounded ridiculous, by not reporting and lying about it, but also had that evening made Marta likewise guilty of treason for having heard about the crime. She reached out and squeezed Dominika's hand. "You must be careful," she said. Marta had devoted her life to this state, had for years ignored its excesses and personally contributed to the downfall of men whose only sin was to succumb to the pleasures of the flesh. But inside, she had long since broken with the bastards. She knew what a situation Dominika was in. "The beasts," she thought. "They will utterly empty this beautiful, intelligent girl, then cast her aside." And if what she was doing even remotely thwarted Vladimir Putin, it would be mortally dangerous. Dominika's knowledge was like a knotted bag of snakes. Safe for the moment, but don't bang it against the wall. Marble's short visit to Helsinki was a triumph in multiple ways. First, Marble himself met and made significant progress with a trade minister, Trunk, thus incontrovertibly establishing the continuing need to pursue the flamboyant Canadian. Second, three nights of midnight to dawn meetings in the Hotel Glow with Nate had already produced 8 highly graded intelligence reports with notes for a possible 37 more on SVR operations in Europe and North America. Third, Marble provided the name of an assistant commissioner in the RCMP's Strategic Policy and Planning Directorate who was meeting a Russian illegal whose day job was as a dancer at the Bear Facts in Ottawa. Last, the old agent repeated from memory, he did not normally have access to China reporting, the gist of 3 superb SVR reports from Beijing, detailing the power struggle still smoldering within the Politburo Standing Committee, fully 2 years after the removal of Bo Zhilai in early 2012. Marble's source comments regarding President Putin's interest, significantly obsessive, he called it, in Chinese Communist Party disunity, were highly valued by analysts. That was just the positive intelligence from Marble. The most explosive item was a hint Marble had picked up that there was a director's case being run out of the 4th floor of Yasinevo, an asset in the pay of Russia, so important and so sensitive that SVR leadership were running the case exclusively. To CIA counterintelligence, this special handling could only mean a mega mole. Some government, some country had a big problem, was gravely penetrated, and they all looked at one another and wondered if it was in Washington. That intel tidbit was compartmented from the rest of Marble's reporting and handled separately. No one had to tell the old spook what to do about this. He told them what he would do. He knew how to pull the string with his fingertips, how to be the spider sitting on the web, waiting for the tremble of the radius threads. He would collect, softly, softly, more information when he could. Meanwhile, the words SVR mole, director's case, and Yasinevo went on the office whiteboards of a dozen counterintelligence analysts in CIA headquarters. They were good at waiting. They would wait for months, even years, to fit more pieces into the mosaic. The last evening, Marble told Nate that Anthony Trunk would within the next 6 months attend an economic conference in Rome, as well as the UN General Assembly in New York, providing 2 future opportunities for Marble to travel out of Russia with plausible cover provided by the SVR's pursuit of Trunk. Headquarters was pleased with this round of Marble meetings and with Nate's performance. A bonus was deposited in Marble's secret fund account, and Nate was awarded a quality step increase amounting to a salary bump of $153 per pay period after taxes. "Wicked good," said Gable when he heard about Nate's QSI. $153, just as long as I don't fucking devalue your contribution. You realize you also get a voucher for 6 free car washes? At the end of the meeting series, before Marble returned to Moscow, Nate pushed gently about the general's security. Marble rather nonchalantly acknowledged that since he and Nate had narrowly missed being rolled up on the snowy Moscow street that one night, it seemed like 100 years ago, there was a serious mole hunt going on inside SVR headquarters in Yasinevo. His old comrade, First Deputy Director Igorov, was convinced someone senior in the Russian service was spying for the CIA. "In other words, me," he said with a laugh. Nate's concern showed on his face. "Look," said Marble, "I am used to the risk. I know how my service works. I know how that Zulik, that old fraud Igorov, thinks and operates. There's no cause for alarm." He thought to himself about 14 years as Langley's agent, of wakeful nights listening to footfalls in the stairwell, or feeling the tightness in his chest when called back to Moscow for consultations. He remembered the inexpressible wave of relief on seeing a full conference room after being summoned to a meeting. Others before him had entered an empty meeting room with the Ubichka, the thugs waiting behind the door. The old man humored his intense young handler, and they reviewed their contingency plans for the biggest high-wire act in denied area operations. Exfiltration, smuggling someone to freedom. From inside Moscow, under hot pursuit, with family or with the mistress, curled tight in a car trunk or brazening it through passport control. After 40 minutes, Marble held up his hand. "Nathaniel, enough for tonight, I think. You are very thorough." Nate blushed in self-conscious embarrassment, and they said goodnight. Now Marble was safely home, and Nate was pleased to read effusive praise from headquarters for the secure and productive meeting series with the agent. A cable had characterized Nate's reporting as well-received at the highest levels. Cablees for the White House and the NSC. Forsythe tapped him on the shoulder for a good job, and Gable brought him a beer.
"All the kudos you're getting, no one's thinking about the agent," said Gable. "It's your responsibility never to forget him. You got that?"
The glow faded with Nate's pressing problem. Dominica. Where was the case going? What did her admission that she worked for the resident mean? If there wasn't some progress soon, there would be complaints from headquarters.
"Screw headquarters," said Gable, starting on another beer. "Just take it easy for a couple weeks. Bask in the glow of your recent scary good performance, then we'll decide what you can do next."
Nate knew Gable well enough by now.
"You really mean get out of this chair and hit the street before I kick you out of the front door, don't you?" said Nate. "Yes, yes, in fact I do," said Gable. "Go to the swimming pool. Find your SVR corporal. Bring her flowers. Tell her you were miserable without her, that you missed seeing her. Take her to dinner."
"To tell you the truth, Marty, I did sort of miss seeing her," said Nate, looking down at the carpet. He looked back up at Gable.
"Jesus wept," said Gable, and walked out.
Caviar Tort. Blend sautéed shallots, creme fraiche, and grated Neufchâtel cheese, and pour mixture into a springform pan. Sprinkle with chopped boiled eggs. Spread a thin layer of small-gauge caviar, Ocetra or Sevruga, on top of tort and chill. Unmold and spread on blinis or toast points. Chapter 14. Marta conspired with Dominica in little ways. She helped her pad attendance and work logs to show activity, and together they talked out how Dominica could write contact reports that showed hopeful progress, while at the same time being sufficiently anodyne not to rouse the sleeping bear in the center. She wrote of pleasant but inconclusive sessions with the American at a museum, a lunch, a coffee, veiled references to his almost languid unresponsiveness.
"It makes him sound horrid," said Dominica. "And it makes me sound horrible, too. We'll be two old maids, you and I."
"You think so?" said Marta, lighting a cigarette. "Perhaps we'll be like the two girls buying sausages. The butcher has no change, so he gives them an extra sausage."
"What are we going to do with the third sausage?" whispers one girl.
"Quiet," her friend says. "We'll eat that one."
Dominica started laughing.
Voluntov was constantly hovering, feeling the pressure from Moscow and passing it downhill. He saw the obvious friendship between the two women, the aging former sparrow and her young friend. And Igorova was clearly abetted by Yelenova. Yelenova's already chronic lack of respect and compliance was increasing and becoming more apparent daily. It was a stormy day with sheeting rain coming in waves from the south, from Estonia. Dominica was out of the embassy when Voluntov called Marta into his office. Marta sat without being bidden, squared her shoulders.
"You want to see me, Colonel?"
Voluntov looked at Marta without speaking. His eyes traveled from her legs to her face. Marta looked him in the eye.
"What is it you wish, Colonel?" Marta repeated.
"I've been noticing your close friendship with Corporal Igorova," said Voluntov. "You and she seem to be spending a fair amount of time together."
"Is there anything wrong with that, Colonel?" asked Marta.
She lit a cigarette, lifted her head, and blew the smoke toward the ceiling. Voluntov watched her like a farm boy.
"What have you been saying to Igorova?" "I'm not sure I understand the question, Colonel," said Marta. "We go out for a glass of wine, we talk about family, travel, food."
"What else do you talk about?" Voluntov asked.
"Do you speak about men, about boyfriends?"
The light from the fluorescent tubes in his office reflected from the sheen of the lapels of his Bulgarian suit.
Excuse me, Colonel, said Marta. What is the reason for these personal questions?
Suken Sien.
Volontov slapped his hand on his desk. I don't have to give you a reason, he bellowed. Whatever you have been saying to Igorova, I want it to stop. Your well-known cynical attitude and jaded views are affecting her. Her productivity has dropped. She's falling behind in her assigned work. Her written reports are unsatisfactory. Leave her alone, or I will take measures. Accustomed to and unaffected by the phlegmy bellows of Soviet officialdom, Marta calmly leaned forward and stubbed her cigarette in the ashtray on his desk. His eyes flicked down to the opening in her blouse. She put her hands on the edge of his desk and leaned farther to give him an even better look. Colonel, I must tell you something. You are repulsive. It is you who should leave Igorova alone. Don't sully her with your disgusting manner. She has done nothing wrong.
Who do you think you're talking to? Yelled Volontov. You're nothing but an overripe whore, Blyadishka.
I can have you sent home tonight, trussed up like the sow you are. You'll be manning a regional travel office at Magnitogorsk, where you can check travel permits all day and suck toothless metallurge hockey players all night. Ah, yes, Colonel, all the familiar threats, said Marta. She knew this species of toad, this kind of coward. But what about this threat, Colonel? I'll go over your head. I'll create so much trouble for you in Moscow that it will be you on your knees at Magnitogorsk. Vanya Igorov will not be pleased to hear that your residentura is a svalka, a trash heap, and your accomplishments are non-existent. He will be quite interested to hear how you leer at his niece and dream of putting your face between her legs. Bastard. Mudak. This was colossal insubordination. This was treason. Volontov stood behind his desk and screamed at Marta.
Pack your belongings. I want you out of here by tomorrow night. I don't care how. Train, boat, plane. If you're not gone by tomorrow night... Zopa, asshole, said Marta, who turned her back on Volontov and walked toward his door.
Trembling with rage, Volontov tore open the desk drawer, scrabbled around in it, and brought out a small Makarov automatic, the pistol he'd had with him all his career. He had never fired it in the field, never fired it in anger. Now, with shaking hand, he racked the slide back to chamber around. At the door, Marta heard the sound and turned. Volontov's pistol was raised, pointed directly at her.
I'm not Dmitry Ustinov, Colonel Volontov. You and your kind cannot destroy every single thing you don't control.
Marta's heart was beating. She didn't know if Volontov would pull the trigger.
Ustinov? The murdered oligarch? Butchered in his penthouse, buckets of blood? Rumored mafia vendetta?
Volontov had no idea what this bitch was talking about, but the 1950s vintage Soviet vacuum tubes in his head heated up. His waterbug instincts told him there was something lurking under the surface, perhaps something very important. He lowered his pistol. Marta turned the knob on his office door and walked out. Colleagues were gathered in the hallway. They had heard the shouting. Inside his office, Volontov smoked a cigarette and tried to calm down. He reached for the secure, creme-colored telephone labeled VCH for Visoko Chastoti, high frequency. Get me Moscow, he said to the operator. After a 30-second wait, he was speaking to First Deputy Director Igorov. 2 minutes later, he had been given instructions. These included, ignore what Yelenova said to him, repeat it to absolutely no one, and do nothing more. Volontov was about to protest that this sort of insubordination would undermine his authority. Over the scratchy line, Igorov told him to pay attention.
Yest chelovek, yest problema. Niet cheloveka, niet problema, said Igorov.
A chill ran through Volontov. He knew that one by heart. One of Comrade Stalin's aphorisms. If there is a person, there is a problem. If there is no person, then there is no problem. Nate and Dominika sat on the couch in his apartment. Lights from the harbor filtered through the window, and the bass note of a ship's horn came from the darkness beyond the islands in the bay. A sweep team had checked Nate's apartment so he could invite Dominica for dinner. Neither knew at this stage who had the operational advantage. Neither knew where his or her respective developmental efforts would lead. Neither fully understood the stakes of the game. All either of them knew was that they looked forward to seeing each other. Nate's little living room was dimly lit with two lamps. Music played softly, Benny Moré ballads. Nate had cooked for Dominica, vitello piccata, veal scallopini with lemon caper sauce. Dominica had stood leaning against the kitchen table watching while Nate lightly sautéed the wafer-thin medallions of meat in oil and butter. She moved closer to the stove as he poured wine and lemon juice into the pan to deglaze the fond, added thin lemon slices and capers, then pieces of cold butter. He put the pieces of veal back into the pan to warm them. They ate dinner on the couch, the plates on their laps. Dominica finished her wine and poured herself another glass. They had picked up their relationship after the break of several weeks ago, had spent time together since then. On a chilly Sunday walking around the old fortress, they had started the familiar argument. "You lived in Moscow for a year, for goodness sake," Dominica said, "but you don't know Russians. Your view is black and white. You haven't learned anything." Nate smiled and offered his hand to help her over a grassy parapet, part of the castle walls. Dominica did not take it and trudged up the mound on her own. "Look, nationalism is fine. You've got a lot to be proud of," said Nate. "But the world is not populated with your enemies. Russia should concentrate on helping her own people." "We do very well, thank you," said Dominica. They continued squabbling in the apartment after dinner. "I'm just saying that Russia hasn't fundamentally changed from the old days, that she is missing the great opportunities before her, that the familiar bad habits are all back." "What bad habits?" asked Dominica. She was drying a plate at the sink. "Corruption, repression, imprisonment. Soviet behavior is the default. It's strangling democracy in Russia." "You almost seem pleased to repeat the list," said Dominica. "I suppose there is none of that in America?" "Well, sure, we have our problems, but we don't let dissidents die in jail or murder political opponents." Nate saw Dominica's face change. "There are people who value humanity, who believe that all humans have rights. It doesn't matter what country they're from. And then there are people who don't seem to care about their fellow man, who have no conscience, like some of the people in the former Soviet Union, in the old KGB. Some of them never went away." Dominica could not believe they were having this conversation. For the first part, it was insulting to sit here being lectured by this young American. For the second part, Dominica knew that much of what he said was correct, but to admit it would be unthinkable. "Now you're an expert," she said, putting the plate down and picking up another. "On the KGB. "Well, I knew one or two of them," said Nate. Dominica continued drying the plate without pausing. "You knew KGB men?" "Impossible. Who were they?" she asked. "And what will you do if he tells you?" she thought. "Nobody you would know. But in comparison, I greatly prefer knowing SVR officers. They're much nicer." That grin again, deep purple. Dominica did not react, but looked at her watch and said it was getting late. Huffy. Nate helped her into her coat, pulling her hair free of the collar. Dominica felt his finger brush her neck as he did so. "Thank you for dinner, Nate," she said. She had her temper in a box, just barely. "May I walk you home?" he asked. "No, thank you," said Dominica. She walked to the front door and turned, offering her hand, but he was right behind her and he put his hand on her shoulder and kissed her lightly on the mouth. "Good night," she said, and went out into the hallway, her lips tingling. Nate's veal piccata. Pound small medallions of veal paper thin. Season and quickly sauté in butter and oil until golden. Remove and cover. Deglaze pan with dry white wine and lemon juice, boil to reduce. Lower heat, add thin lemon slices, capers, and cold butter. Gently simmer to a thick reduction, do not bring back to a boil. Return medallions to sauce to warm. Chapter 15. Past midnight now, the Helsinki snow had given way to the rains of emergent spring, which spattered on the pavement, dripped off the bare limbs of the trees, and rattled against the windows. Nate tossed in his bed. 12 blocks away, Dominika lay awake, hearing the rain and felt the lingering tingle of Nate's goodnight kiss on her lips. She was glad she had saved him, and she would do it again, she decided. Thank God for Marta. Not only had her friend's support helped her with the decision, but also Marta's wry commentary on life had crystallized her thinking, especially about keeping a secret from the service. Marta did not believe in blind devotion. She told Dominika not to be a tricoteuse, to be true to herself, to owe allegiance first to herself, then, if there was room, to Russia. Dominika tossed in her bed. 5 blocks to the east, Marta Yelenova eased open her apartment door in the residence block reserved for Russian embassy employees. Cooking smells of boiled beef and cabbage were heavy in the corridor and reminded her of apartment blocks in Moscow. She shook the rain off her overcoat and hung it on a hook next to the door. Her apartment was small, a single room with a separate kitchen nook, beyond which was the tiny bathroom. The apartment had been used by generations of Russian embassy employees and was dingy and worn, the furniture scarred and wobbly. Marta stumbled as she took off her wet shoes. She giggled to herself. She was tipsy after a long night alone in a small cafe. At some point during the evening, she had ordered pitepana, a popular Scandinavian hash of beef, onion, and potatoes. She had left the bar and walked home in the rain. It had been some time since her blow-up with Volontov, and the expected recall to Moscow, the reprimands, the firing from the service had not come. The resident studiously ignored her, but absolutely nothing had happened. Marta saw that Dominika in the last days was trying to schedule more frequent operational meetings with Nathaniel, primarily because that was what kept Volontov happy, but also, Marta observed, because Dominika looked forward to contact with the young American. Volontov had called her into his office as well, and Dominika returned to her desk, giving Marta a wink. "He was very calm, almost apologetic," said Dominika over wine after work. "He encouraged me to keep working, to try to pick up the pace if I could." "I don't trust that jellyfish," said Marta. "My advice, Domi, is to keep telling them you're working very diligently. Progress is slow, but you're encouraged by developments. They all want to report success to the center, so Volontov will keep up a good face." Later that night, walking home, she tipsily told Dominika that if either of them had any sense, they'd both defect. Scandalous. Marta went into her bedroom. She sat heavily on her bed, peeled off her damp clothes, and let them fall in a heap to the floor. She put on a short silk pajama skirt. It was from India, light beige, billowing and embroidered with green and gold thread. Matching green knotted buttons ran from throat to hem. She stood in front of a wall mirror with its cracked corner and looked at herself. The shirt had been a present from a GRU general who had been posted to the Soviet embassy in New Delhi. He had met Marta during the honey trap operation against the Indian defense minister. They had had a torrid affair for 8 weeks, but in the end, he stopped it. Having the Queen Sparrow as a Moscow diversion was one thing, he said, but settling down with someone like you was another. "Someone like me," Marta thought, looking at her reflection. She opened the nightshirt and looked at her naked body in the mirror. Several years past 50, and she was still holding together, she thought. A little more waistline, some lines around her eyes, but her breasts had not completely fallen, and, turning slightly and holding the material aside, She saw that her backside still had the swoop and curve that had been in large part responsible for making the young French intel officer in 1984 forget his duty and spend a month of Sundays in a Leningrad hotel room with her. She thought about him sometimes, for no reason. Marta padded barefoot into the kitchen to draw a glass of water. It would clear her head so she could sleep. She returned to the bedroom and felt an arm snake around her neck from behind. She had heard nothing. The man held tight against her throat. She grabbed his arm with both hands to relieve the pressure. The person behind her didn't feel big. In fact, he felt somewhat thin. The breath on her neck was steady. He wasn't scared. He did not overly tighten his grip on her throat. He was just holding her. Marta thought maybe a pervert, a molestation. She got ready to reach behind to twist his testicles off. It wasn't until he had frog-marched her sideways to stand in front of the mirror that she knew this wasn't the finished delivery boy with a wet spot on the front of his apron. She smelled ammonia and sweat, then something else. A voice in her ear like a beetle walking across rice paper. One word in Russian. Молчат. Silence. In a horrified flash, she knew. It was them. There was a creature looking out over her shoulder into the mirror. Their eyes met. More specifically, her eyes met his single eye. The other, a chalky marble in its socket, stared obliquely. In the dim light of her bedroom, Marta could not see his body, just his disembodied arm and pocked, scarred face behind her, floating over her shoulder. His voice started scuttling again. "Good evening, Comrade Yelenova. May I call you Marta, or perhaps my little sparrow?" Marta's nightshirt was slightly open. The gold highlights in the shirt were vibrating, picking up the trembling in Marta's body. Her pubic delta was visible between the folds of the slightly open shirt. The monster pulled her a little straighter. Marta was lifted to her toes. "My little sparrow," the man whispered. "What have you been doing?" He moved her, still up on her toes, a step closer to the mirror. Marta looked in the mirror and saw her own terrified eyes looking back at her. "Will you share your bed with me, little sparrow?" the man said. "I have come a long way." A second hand, black gloved and holding a 2-foot-long knife with a curved handle, came from behind and crossed her body. The man flicked one side of her shirt farther open with the tip of the knife. Her breast was heaving in fright. The floating head behind her smiled, tucked his chin into the crook of her neck, and tightened his grip. Marta's vision of herself in the mirror was going gray at the edges. A rushing noise in her head grew louder. She heard the devil say, "Pokazat gidye raki zimyut." "I will show you where the crayfish spend winter." She knew this phrase, its deadly portent. Then the rushing noise got louder, and she passed out. Marta regained consciousness quickly, like a surfacing rush, coming back up to the light. She was naked on her back on her narrow, bitter little bed. She felt the pull of tape over her mouth. Her hands were tied behind her, the knots on her wrists dug into her back. The familiar bedside lamp with its faded, gauzy pink shade cast a mild light on the bedspread. Her legs were tied together at the ankles. She pulled and tested each knot, but there was no give. She heard a noise, turned her head, and her heart stopped. It was the most terrifying thing she had ever seen. The man was wearing her India shirt. He was dancing around the little room, rocking his body forward and back. The knife was in his hand, and he occasionally twirled it above his head as he pirouetted. Marta began weeping silently. Sergei Maturin was 4,500 kilometers away on a head trip to the Panjshir Valley. He contemplated the shadows cast by the little pink lamp in Marta's bedroom. He was in his Alpha Group's sandbag bunker built into the hill with the hissing gas lantern casting green light into the corners of the shelter. Marta's trussed-up body became the body of the wife of the village headman, taken hostage during a dawn raid as punishment for sheltering insurgents. The Helsinki rain pattering against the window was the howling Hundred Nights wind that carried the sands of the northern desert up and over the Kush in billowing clouds and shook the bunker's corrugated tin door. Khyber was home again. The Afghan woman had died sometime in the early evening. Too much excitement or too much handling by a succession of his troopers, or perhaps the ammo belt around her neck stapled to the plywood wall had gotten too tight across her throat. She was upright against the wall, chin up as if in pride, held by the collar, her dead eyes flashing green from the lantern. She kept Khyber company. He was sitting, swaying to tinny Afghan music from a tape deck, but the batteries were fading and the music kept slowing down and speeding up. Marta thrashed from side to side, hoping to loosen one arm, get her legs free, to be able to fight him. Her movement attracted his attention, and he climbed on the foot of the bed, on hands and knees, started inching toward her. The shirt billowed around his body. He hovered over her, looking down, pressing his weight on her. She kept straining her arms, the cords in her neck standing out. Mathurin lowered his face inches from hers and looked into her eyes, listened to her huffing breaths. He ripped the tape from her mouth and savored her labored, panicked breathing.
"Boja," she whispered.
His eyes searched her face as his unseen hand shivered the tip of the Khyber knife at a shallow angle up under her diaphragm nearly 9 inches, completely through her heart and up into her throat. Marta arched her back, convulsing. Her open mouth could make no sound, and her body bucked against the ropes. Mathurin rode the tremors in her body, felt her hoarse breaths quicken, and watched the light go out in eyes that partially rolled back inside her head. A trickle of blood oozed from one nostril and out the corner of her mouth. It took Marta 3 minutes to die. She didn't hear Mathurin whisper,
"Boja?"
No, God could not be here tonight. Dominika entered the residentura the next morning and looked over at Marta's empty desk. Probably a long night of aquavit, she thought. When Marta had not come in by mid-morning, Volontov stuck his head out of his office and yelled, "Where is Yelenova this morning? Has she called in sick?" No one knew where she was. "Corporal Igorova, call her at her flat. See if you can reach her." Dominika dialed several times, but no one answered. Volontov called the security officer and told him to go over to her apartment, pound on the door, use the office copy of her key to get in. He returned an hour later to say that the apartment was empty, but looked perfectly normal. Clothes in the closet, dishes in the sink, bed made. "Draft a short cable to the center," barked Volontov to the security man, who looked at Volontov like a Rottweiler waiting for hand signals. "Inform them that Administrative Assistant Yelenova, Marta, has not reported for work, whereabouts unknown. She has not called in sick. Inform them that we are searching for her, and also filing a request to the Finnish National Police to search for her. Call your contact in the police. Tell him the embassy demands immediate action and utmost discretion. Go." Volontov called his counterintelligence referent into the office and shut the door. "We may have a problem," he said. "Marta Yelenova has not reported to work." He checked the SVR issue wall clock above the door. "It's been almost 5 hours," he said. His line KR man, an unimaginative beast of burden, formerly from the KGB Border Guards Directorate, looked at his watch as if to confirm Volontov's estimate of the time. "Get over to Supo," Volontov said. "Ask for an appointment with Sundquist. Tell them about Yelenova, that we think she's been kidnapped. Ask them to check all the terminals, air, rail, ship." "Kidnapped?" asked the CI man. "Who would kidnap Yelenova?" "Idiot, we're not going to tell Finnish intelligence we think she defected. Just get them to start checking. They'll have visa photos of her. Tell them utter discretion is imperative and keep your mouth shut." In the next 6 hours, the police had made no progress, but Supo had retrieved a photo of a woman vaguely resembling Yelenova at the Haparanta border crossing station at the Swedish border on the Gulf of Bothnia. The woman was wearing a scarf and dark glasses that concealed most of her face, but the nose and chin were right. Supo said the woman was processed through immigration control with a Finnish passport in the name of Rita Viren, a name the Finns were tracing. She was in the company of an unidentified man with sunglasses and a baseball cap. "That confirms it," said the CI man. "It was the Americans. She defected to the CIA." "Imbecile. How did you arrive at that?" said Volontov. "Look at the ball cap, Colonel," said the CI man, pointing at the Supo security video photos that had been faxed to the Russians. "It says New York on the cap." Volontov told him to get out. The office was afloat in rumors. A murder? A kidnapping? The word no one dared to utter. Defection? Everyone knew Marta and Volontov had had a screaming match several weeks ago. But to run away? Dominika was beside herself. Marta would not defect, but if she did, she would not leave without saying goodbye. She had only joked about both of them defecting together. No, something bad had happened. Then she froze. Did they somehow know she, Dominika, was not reporting, falsifying progress with Nash? Was Marta's disappearance a warning? Ridiculous. There was some very easy explanation. Marta had run off for a week to Lapland with a blonde yoga instructor. Anything. But Dominika couldn't convince herself. The search for Yelenova continued for days without result. Volontov was frantic that the disappearance of one of his people would stain his copybook at the center. An ironic fixation considering his pokey 30-year career ledger was already liberally blotted with sloth, inattention, and careerism. The embassy protested to the Finnish Ministry of Foreign Affairs and to the Interior Ministry about the criminal kidnapping of one of its diplomatic personnel, whose security, they reminded the uncomfortable Finns, was the direct responsibility of the Finnish government. A special Moscow investigator arrived from Directorate K to interview embassy officers and the resident, as well as to confer with Finnish investigators. He left after 4 days, solemnly concluding that Ms. Yelenova had disappeared. Dominika suspected the truth as she lay face down on her bed in her SVR-provided apartment and wept for her friend. She had been a true friend, a big sister she never had, and it was monstrous, inconceivable, that they would have harmed her. But why? As she ran things through her mind, the memory of her telling Marta about Ustinov came back in a chilling rush. Did they know about that? Did Marta mention it to someone? Would a slip on her part result in the disappearance of a colleague, an officer of the service, from sleepy little Helsinki in the 21st century, in a sane, civilized world? She closed her eyes and felt the bed spinning, and she was in Ustinov's love nest, on his blood-soaked revolving bed. Thinking back, she remembered Volontov's face had shown fear. His orange halo was ragged with it. She got up, walked to the window, and looked up at the night sky. She scorned herself. Trained intelligence officer, a real operator, relentless seductress. They used her, were using her still, as a little chess piece, a little pawn. Whoever it was that Nate was handling, she could understand that person a little better now, appreciate the hate that must sustain him. Dominika, more than ever, was confirmed in her decision not to report on Nate. It had been like a draft of cold air sweeping across her, but her little games were passive, weren't they? She saw Marta's face in the glass. How could she make them atone for what they had done to her? How could she destroy them, Volontov, Uncle Vanya, all the others? Tears ran down her cheeks. She cried for Marta, for her father, perhaps for herself, too. She cried for Russia, but she knew she no longer believed. She turned away from the window, eyes closed. Something broke loose inside her, and she swept a little ceramic bud vase. Marta had bought it for her at the Sunday market, off a side table with her arm, her teeth clenched and fists bunched. Back in the Residentura, filled with dread, Volontov was waiting for official censure in some form. Instead, he received a sympathetic call on the Veche, the VCH phone, from Vanya Igorov, who commiserated that service in the field on the front lines was not without risk. There had been defectors in the past, there will be defectors in the future. We deplore them, he said, and we must be vigilant, but it's impossible to prevent all of them. Igorov asked Volontov to concentrate on managing secure operations, and especially to focus on the special project with his niece and the young American. Of course, General, said a relieved Volontov. I believe we are making good progress on that front. Chushsobatya, bullshit, thought Igorov, and ended the call. Vanya knew that his niece must have mentioned at least part of the Ustinov story to this Yelenova woman, a serious mistake, but one he had to overlook for the time being. It was actually a stroke of luck that Yelenova subsequently let it slip in front of the mouth-breather Volontov, who blessedly had the wit to call him. It was only a matter of dispatching Maturin, then a relatively simple conspiratia to send the investigator for show to wrap up all the loose ends. God, if the president had gotten wind of this breach, Igorov didn't want to think about it. On the Finnish-Russian border 3 kilometers west of Yartsilia, Russia, through an uninhabited tract of dense pines and rolling hills, the Soviets, after World War II, had established an infiltration route past the towers, border wire, and plowed strips. The Finnish side was always lightly patrolled. For decades, cleared KGB border guards periodically were assigned to the area to allow agents to pass through unmolested. The more techniques changed, the more they stayed the same. Routes through the minefields in 1953 were marked by stakes driven into the snow with cloth strips tied to them. Since 2010, the correct route through the field was marked by plastic pylons, fitted with infrared strobes visible only with night vision goggles. A week earlier, Maturin had infiltrated Finland using this route, was picked up by a Directorate S support illegal on Country Road No. 70, and was driven 400 kilometers south on a rural Route 6, and finally into the city on State Highway E-75. The Spetsnaz killer had gone directly to Yelenova's apartment, killed her at midnight, and put her body in a rubber military body bag. He had sanitized the apartment, then signaled the illegal, who in the early morning hours drove Maturin and Marta's body back north to the Vyartsilia bolt hole. The illegal then returned to Helsinki. The next morning, using real Finnish documents, the illegal and his lightly disguised wife left the country at Harperanta, ostensibly for the start of a nice vacation in Sweden. They would never return to Finland, further complicating the investigation into what had happened to Marta Yelenova. The entire operation had taken a little less than 40 hours. The sunlight was rising through the pine woods of Vyartsilia, casting long, delicate shadows that crept up the snow-covered hills. Guards from the Federal Security Service stood in elevated Tower B-30, watching the tree line with binoculars. The sun came up behind the tower, over the tops of the pines, bathing the whole area in golden light. "Vot," said one of the men. "There." A single thin figure came out of the trees. He was dressed in a white snowsuit with a hood and wore snowshoes. The guard saw he moved steadily through the drifts, his long shadow stretched out behind him. He dragged a small equipment sled on a tether. An oblong shape lay on the sled, shrouded in white nylon. Marta Yelenova had returned to the Rodina. Marta's last meal. Pit i panna. In foaming butter, separately and aggressively brown cubed beef, potatoes, and diced onions until crisp. Incorporate ingredients in the skillet with additional butter. Season and reheat. Form a well in the mixture and break a raw egg into it. Stir the egg into the hash before serving. Chapter 16. Nate sat with Gable in the India Prankari in Kallio, at the back, looking out the windows. The restaurant was nearly empty. Gable had insisted on ordering Rogan Josh, fragrant, spicy, oily vermilion lamb stew. They ate it with soft bread, a fiery relish of tomatoes and ginger, and copious amounts of beer. Gable compared his first spoonful to a Nepalese Rogan Josh he had tasted around a campfire in Dahran 100 years ago, waiting at the airstrip beside the pilatus that had infiltrated the 4 Tibetans into China. "Fucking Scandinavians cannot prepare Indian food," he said, chewing. "With them, it's all reindeer and punk berries and cream sauce, boiled potatoes. Chef reaches for parsley and they have a stroke." As usual, food was disappearing into Gable's craw at a prodigious rate. 4 little guys, Sherpas, tough as nuts, trained them for a month. Gonna pop in and pop out, splice a relay on a PLA trunk line running along the border, literally in the shadow of Everest and Kanchenjunga. The fucking end of the world. They flew in over the mountains, were supposed to walk out, but they never came back. Chi-Com patrol probably got them. He was silent for a minute, then waved for more of the relish, and they started talking about the Diva case, how to kickstart it. Nate couldn't pin her down, he couldn't turn the corner with her. She wasn't softening. He was wasting precious time. Gable stopped chewing and stared at him when Nate admitted he had grown to like her. "She's willing to come out, to engage. We debate stuff, but there's no give," said Nate. "You ever think she's working on you, not the other way around?" said Gable, chewing. "Not impossible," said Nate. "But there's no handle she's been working on, no career bullshit, no money, nothing." "Yeah, and what would you do if she showed up with nothing on under a raincoat? Think you'd call that a recruitment peg?" Nate looked at Gable, nettled. "I don't think she'd go with that kind of approach. Just a gut feeling." "You wish. Well, it sounds like you guys are stuck. I suggest you think of something to unstick the case. Shake her up, rattle her, upset her equilibrium." He emptied his beer and called for 2 more. "She's not going to go with the standard canned pitch, Marty," said Nate. "I've been trying to get her to talk more about Russia, about the problems. Not pushing her, just giving her openings. Something there in her eyes, but not yet." "You have to look for another handle. The good life in the West, luxury items, bank account." "Wrong direction," said Nate. "It's not who she is. She's idealistic, a nationalist. But she's not a clunky Soviet. She grew up with ballet, music, books, languages." "You talk about the Kremlin, all the shit going on behind the walls?" "Sure I did," said Nate. "But she's too gung-ho. She looks at it all at the level of the Rodina." "Hell's that?" said Gable. "The whole national myth, the motherland, the soil, the hems, chasing Nazis across the steppes." "Oh, yeah. Some of those Russian Red Army girls were hot," said Gable, looking up at the ceiling. "Those tunics and boots, they looked..." "Is this your idea of operational coaching? Are we discussing Diva?" "Well, you have to find something to jolt her out of her defensive position." He leaned back in his chair, rocking slightly, hands behind his head. "Don't discount her feelings for you," said Gable. "Maybe she'll want to help you in your career, a gift. It won't feel to her like she's committing treason. Or maybe she's a thrill freak. Some agents drink adrenaline." Nate's doorbell rang that night. Dominika stood at the door, her face pinched, eyes red. She was not crying, but her lips trembled, and she put her hand over her mouth as if to stifle a sob. Nate checked the hallway quickly while pulling her inside the door. She was leaden. She didn't resist his tug. He took her coat. She was wearing a white stretch top and jeans. He lowered her gently onto the couch. She sat at the edge of the cushion, looking down at her hands. Nate didn't know what was wrong or what to do. She was being sent home short of tour. She was in trouble. That would be a first. X-filing an SVR officer before recruitment. Got to calm her down, whatever it is she's upset, vulnerable. A glass of wine, scotch, vodka? Teeth chattering against the glass as she took a sip. "I know you speak Russian," Dominika said suddenly in Russian, her voice flat, exhausted. Her head was still down, her hair hung on each side of her face. You're the only one I can talk to, a boy from the CIA. It's mad, isn't it? A boy from the CIA, thought Nate. Fuck's going on? He sat still, made himself blink. Dominica took another ragged sip. She started talking slowly in a low voice. She told him about Marta.